Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey, everyone. Welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here, along with Shadmar Quits. We are your hosts again for this weekend show, and also recorded a number of interviews and a lot of company updates again throughout this week. It was a little bit more interesting of a trading week because we did have the Fed and a little bit more volatility and a little bit more positive moves when it comes to a broad range of sectors, more in the middle of the week. But again, I think we all know that we are still very much in the middle of this summer trading session, let's call it. I also want to wish everybody in Canada a happy long weekend. August long weekend, always one of my favorite long weekends because usually just nicer weather. That being said, we're kicking off the show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro-Pacific Gold Fund. Now, Adrian, we're going to start off here focused in the royalty space for metals. Because, look, we had a lot of interviews this week with a wide range of a lot of the small and mid-tier size royalty companies. And look, there's no denying that there's been an explosion in terms of the royalty space and royalty companies. And I think it gets a little confusing for some investors understanding what makes a good royalty company simply because there are royalty companies out there that don't have cash flowing royalties. And they, I guess, are branding themselves as royalty companies, but that's a bit of a stretch sometimes just because they have non-producing royalties in their portfolio. Adrian, I know you invest in a few royalty companies. What do you focus most on when you're analyzing the different royalty companies in the space?
Yeah, well, good day, Corey Shad. Thank you for having me. That's a good question, and you've set the groundwork well. And we'll talk about the explosion of new companies and what that means for the sector maybe in a second, if we may. But what do I look for? Well, first of all, above everything else, I look for management. I always look for management in smaller companies, but it's true pretty much on any of the royalties. Management to me is absolutely key. And what does management mean? It means a lot of things. It means in the royalty space, I think in addition to everything else that you'd expect, it means a discipline. Discipline to pass on deals that are not good deals. And I think that is perhaps one of the most difficult things for royalty companies. And the reason I say that is because clearly, I mean, you see it in the market, but it's logical. When a royalty company has the more diversified the stream of income or near-term income, the more diversified, the better the multiples, right? So newer companies want to grow rapidly because, you know, when you've just got one royalty on your books, you have a much lower multiple than if you can get 3, 4, 5 on your books. And so the smaller companies, there's a temptation, and frankly, for new companies, it's a balancing act, but there's a balance between growing quickly and maintaining that discipline and only doing good deals, which with the proliferation of royalty companies, doing good deals is more and more difficult, frankly. You want good management that has discipline. You also want, you know, some diversity in the income stream or the near-term income stream. Those are the two key things, I think, in royalty companies that I look at.
Well, Adrian, you bring up a couple good points there because I do think with the proliferation of companies, we're seeing sometimes bidding wars where certain royalties get bid up and up and up, and now the company is now possibly overpaying for that royalty just to say, hey, we've got a producing asset, or hey, we've got this key development asset. But there's also some companies that have a really strong ratio of how many producing royalties they have to their overall number. And there's other companies that have a huge book of royalties, but a very small percentage of them are actually cash flowing. And a lot of their value that they bring to the market is the development pipeline and what they see as the future development, but that doesn't really pay investors now. And then some people are more aggressive with the dividend, some are not more aggressive with the dividend. Is there any other areas that you look at? Like, do you like to see precious metal focus only? Do you like it when they have a mix of assets where they may have some other commodities in there? Are you animated at all by some of the new base metal ones that we're seeing develop, and or even the uranium ones are developing? There's a lot of different royalty companies that are coming to market.
Yeah.
Are there any of those that animate you?
I think for me, the key is that the company says what it is. So I can go along with a royalty company which doesn't have any producing assets or even no near-term producing assets, but has a good portfolio of large-scale, you know, earlier stage developmental, let's say. I mean, you don't want only exploration, obviously. So I can go along with any of those things. I can go along with a primarily gold royalty company, precious metals royalty company, but also has some other resources. Or I can go along with a pure royalty company, pure precious metals. Again, I think the key is, and I wouldn't necessarily say I prefer one over the other, the key is to know what you're buying and not get sort of knocked over by companies that sort of go off the rails with what they said they were going to do. I mean, let's face it, Franco-Nevada has well over 10% of its revenue now from oil and gas, well over 10%. And so, you know, when they started that, I remember that when they started that, oh gosh, 20 years ago now, they got a lot of criticism for getting into oil and gas. But it served them well. And it's been a good balance. I mean, it's only a small percentage, but, well, relatively small percentage. But it's been a good balance to gold, where sometimes that's produced revenue when the precious metals haven't. And again, you know what you're getting when you buy Franco. So in answer to your question, for me personally, the key is really to know what you're getting. I think you also want companies to stick with their expertise. I mean, I don't really want a small company where clearly gold and silver are their expertise. That's what they know. You don't really want them trying to compete in the uranium space, for example, because it's they're probably not going to get the best deals at the best prices. You know, one of the problems with the bidding wars and everything else, I think it's true to say that you're not going to get really good deals at the moment by buying existing royalties, with few exceptions. Some companies, like Metalla, is a good example. You mentioned Metalla. Oh, that was before we went live. I'm sorry. But you mentioned Metalla as an example. Or, you know, Metalla's been good at getting existing royalties and doing it through avenues and contacts and so on. Once an existing royalty gets into a bidding war, an auction, let's say, once it gets into an auction and other companies are invited in, it is very, very difficult to get a good deal, because there is always two things. There's always some company for which a particular royalty perhaps makes more sense than someone else. They've got a royalty next door or whatever. And so they're prepared to pay more. But more importantly, there's always some company that just needs to do a deal because shareholders are shouting at them, you haven't done a deal all year, what's going on? And they just feel pressure to do a deal. And there's always someone willing to overpay. That's the problem. So the two things to look at, I think, and I didn't mention this earlier, but it comes with management and their experience. It comes with the experience. Does management have good contacts in the industry? You know, do they have lots of people that they can go to talk about royalties and try to get, I'll call it an inside deal. That's not, I don't mean that in a, you know, legal sense. An inside track, let's say, where maybe they have an advantage on buying a package of existing royalties and can make it and can buy them without them going to auction. And that happens sometimes. It happens less and less these days because I think everyone, the companies that have royalties inside, and also just individuals that own royalties on projects. I think increasingly pretty much everyone these days knows there's a lot of companies out there. But still, you know, you can approach a rancher or a landowner and talk to them and, you know, get on the right wavelength with them and spend time with them. It takes time. You know, you've got to be patient. And maybe 6 months or a year later, you consummate a deal because the guy's happy with what you're offering and you're happy with the price you're paying. And he never even suggests going to auction. But that's getting increasingly unusual. And of course, the other way is to create royalties. But for the smaller companies, creating royalties is much more difficult. You know, that's obviously something that Franco and the bigger companies do more and more. You know, most of Franco's, certainly in dollar terms, most of Franco's royalties and streams over the last multiple years have been ones they've created rather than, you know, existing royalties they've bought. But, you know, as I say, a lot easier for the bigger companies. The other thing I would say, if I may, I don't know if you were being negative on, you know, companies who call themselves royalty companies but don't have any revenue stream. You know, I mean, they're also what I'll call hybrid companies, and that might be, you know, an Altius, which is in the base metal, which is one of the bigger ones. Or it might be, let's say, an Origin, which you know, has morphed from a prospect generator the aim is to generate prospects with the goal of collecting royalties. So I don't see anything wrong in that personally. I mean, again, you just have to analyze each company on its own merits. But it's not the same as buying an Osisko or Sandstorm, obviously.
Oh, exactly, Adrian. And I was just saying that you're right, a little bit tongue-in-cheek and also a little bit negative in terms of some of the new entrants into the space that, quite frankly, to me, aren't royalty companies. But the ones that you have mentioned and some of the hybrid ones that have grown to be royalty companies, those are more real companies. It's just some of these new entrants that have me a bit worried.
But I agree with you completely. But it's you know, we get this all the time, don't we, Corey? When marijuana's hot, you know, well, let's not say marijuana. When nickel's hot, you know, in the 1970s, everybody becomes a nickel company, even though they know nothing about nickel. And when uranium's hot, everybody suddenly switches from gold to uranium because gold's down and uranium's a hot. Shouldn't use hot with the word hot when you're talking about uranium, but, you know, uranium is the hot resource. And people move around and they don't know anything about it, and now royalties are the hot space and everyone's becoming a royalty company. I couldn't agree with you more on that. I couldn't agree with you more. But, you know, the truth is there's some really good quality companies out there. Really, I mean, really good quality, with good quality management among both the seniors and some of the juniors. I mean, some of the juniors are very, very small, but they have good quality management. Some managements, like I think Star Royalty would be a good example. I think they're going to grow a little slower than maybe some others because they are more disciplined than, and I don't want to name names, but they're more disciplined than some of the other smaller companies that want to grow more rapidly. Time will tell whether, you know, growing more rapidly actually achieves more success. But there's no question that the patient approach is a much more low risk approach. You know, we've seen many companies over the years, and I think we can say it now because it's in their history, but I mean, Sandstorm will be an example as well, where in their early days, I mean, they just tried to grow too rapidly and they did some pretty lousy deals that bit them. As I say, that's in their history, so I don't want anyone to take anything negative about Sandstorm away from that comment. But trying to grow too rapidly can backfire.
Well, Adrian, you brought up a couple interesting points there. I want to circle back to one or two of them. One of them was you talked about how sometimes people get into that flavor of the day. But we have seen some good ideas, at least on the business model, working in royalty space in base metals. It originally worked in oil and gas. So circling back to the Franco comment, like that's probably where they got the idea. And Wheaton and
it is indeed. Yeah.
And so now when we see new entrants in the royalty space, or we see the, you know, battery metal space getting hot and it's trending, we see companies focused on just base metals, and they've had their own day in the sun. So we are seeing some of these different sectors pop up. And if the royalty model is a good business model, I don't hold that against them for wanting to apply that same model in a different commodity. I just think it's harder to get the deals in smaller niche sectors. But one thing you brought up was the difference between how certain companies make acquisitions. And I maybe want to spend just a second longer there. So there are certain companies that like a Maverick, for example, that's buying baskets of royalties from senior producers. That's one strategy. There's other companies, like you mentioned, Metalla, that tend to do one deal at a time, but they try to make them accretive deals. And it may take, like you said, working on putting together a lot of different partners to find a deal that works for everybody. And there's certain companies that have proprietary databases where they're going out and trying to pick off ones no one else is bidding on. But you also brought up that other important category, and that is certain companies create their own streams or their own royalties depending on the setup. And those are becoming more rare, but there are a few newer companies that are going to try to use that same model and create their own streams with the companies. And I would argue the prospect generators used to do that. They used to go out and have 10 different properties going, and they would try to bring in the JV partner, and their holdout would be, hey, what I'd really like is a 2-3% net smelter royalty on this project if you take it all the way through. And so I'm curious to get your take. Do you think we'll see some of these royalty companies start trying to pick off the assets that the prospect generators have, or do you think we'll see a new wave of prospect generators that do what EMX Royalties did, where they started as a prospect generator, did a lot of creative deals, got a basket of royalties out of it, and really became a royalty powerhouse over time? It took them about 2 decades. Do you think we'll see more of that between the prospect generators and the royalty companies?
Wow, huge, lots of topics, lots of things you mentioned, even though there was only one question at the end, but there were lots of interesting things there. Yeah, just if I may, to touch base on a couple of things you mentioned, but don't let me forget the question. On the base metals, I agree with you completely. You know, part of the problem with the non-precious metals is that there do tend to be a lot fewer. There tend to be fewer royalties available, and you know, particularly when you're talking base metals and you're talking not only producing but you're talking developmental projects, you are talking huge projects. So I mentioned Star, for example. I mean, Star can't go to BHP and say, you know, we'd like to do a stream on, Escondida or something. I mean, it just wouldn't work. There's only Franco and Wheaton and maybe and Royal, but are really the size that can really deal with that sort of thing. So they're trying to pick up. So it's a lot more difficult, is what I'm saying, from the base metal ones. But, you know, some of the companies like Nova, I know you talked to Nova, you know, which is affiliated in some way, not formally affiliated, but affiliated with Metalla. You know, they're doing a very good job at building a portfolio. But it's a lot more difficult, in my view. Proprietary databases is interesting because there are certainly royalties inside non-precious metal companies. So, you know, inside whatever, an Australian telephone company or something, and having the proprietary database or the knowledge of that is very helpful because those companies are less likely to understand. Those companies are less likely to immediately grasp the idea that, well, wait a minute, I should go to an auction on this. Whereas, you know, the gold companies are much more likely to understand that. But if you're not talking, if you're talking about, so I think that's absolutely true, but there are some companies, Vox, for example, that has more more knowledge of those kind of royalties in Australia, where they have more insight and knowledge. But when it comes to royalties in royalty companies, I don't think there's really anything such as propriety. I mean, everybody knows what's out there, I think. Although sometimes the companies themselves forget about them. And I'm sorry, what was the question?
On the prospect generators, do you think, and those are all great points, Adrian, but on the prospect generators, it used to be they created royalties, and then I wonder if now we'll see a feeding frenzy where the royalty companies will go after the prospect generators.
Yeah. I think that's the next stage we're going to get in the development of royalty companies. We're going to see more acquisitions, and that might be buying individual assets from prospect generators, but it might be buying an entire junior royalty company. Remember, a lot of the smaller companies, a lot of the prospect generators and the prospect generators that are morphing into royalty companies, they don't really want to sell one of their royalties. I mean, because they're trying to build a portfolio of royalties. So unless the price was extraordinary, I won't name names, but they don't want to sell those royalties. Why would they? Because they're trying to build a portfolio of royalties. But I think you're going to see more acquisitions in the space. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true.
All right, Adrian, we're out of time for these segments. I really appreciate you spending two segments with us and a dive into those royalty companies. Again, everybody, if you want to hear either the replay of the webinar with Elemental Royalties that I did, that will be posted early next week, and any of the interviews that we had with royalty companies over this last week, be sure to visit our website, kereport.com, and click on all those interviews. Adrian, always great chatting with you, buddy. Thank you for taking time this weekend. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to shift a little bit away from the metal sector right now, although we will touch on it as we are chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Dana, let's talk big picture about these markets and starting off with what we're in the middle of here. Summer doldrums, slow summer trading, or at least that's what I'm seeing on a lot of the charts that I am following. Now, in the slow summer session, we have seen a little bit of the momentum to the upside from the U.S. equity markets wane. But that being said, we're recording this later in the day on Thursday, and U.S. equity markets, again, the S&P just hit some new all-time highs. Dana, let's just start off with this general summer doldrums. I know last summer, very different than this summer. We didn't experience this slow trading last summer. There was a lot to talk about and a lot of aggressive moves going on in the markets. What's your assessment of this summer, these slower trading sessions, how long it could last, and any data that you're seeing that does actually confirm that we just have less investors in the space right now?
Sure, Corey. Yeah, I'm not sure if it has as much to do with that. There is a seasonality bent to it, of course, that typically you see some slow trading in the summer months. And so it's not unusual for us to see that. On the other hand, I think a lot of it has to do with kind of the cycle, the near term, the intermediate term cycle. So last year, for example, you had the crash in March and then the recovery subsequently. So we had some momentum going through the summer months that aided in a little bit of a more positive period last summer. This summer, we had that huge rally off of the election time last year, which we've talked about. So since we've been talking about it ever since maybe March, April, or in around that period, that we had such a huge rally that It's only normal to consolidate or move sideways for a time just to work off those near-term excesses that were built up in that rally. And I think we're still in that phase. So it's not unusual to see some sideways action. It happens to be in the summer month, which might, you know, exacerbate kind of the doldrums, the slow trading. But I think a lot of it has to do with just working off those excesses following that rally since the that post-election rally that we're in. So right now, of late, we've talked about the most concerning thing that we've seen has been the kind of lack of participation over the last month to 6 weeks among in the broad market. We have seen, as you mentioned, the major averages continue to hit higher highs, continue to probe all-time highs. So that's a positive. On the negative side, we haven't seen the breadth and the participation among the broad market and the smaller and mid caps that we would prefer to see as the major averages are hitting highs, new highs. That would confirm kind of the high quality, the sustainability of such a move. So from that aspect, it would kind of suggests that there's more to go in terms of this two-way market that we've been calling our consolidation phase. So we expect over the next, month to a couple months, more sideways action and continue to deploy the game plan that we've been using for over the last several months of just kind of a trading market. You know, buy the dips, sell the rips, don't get too aggressive, go for singles rather than home runs, as we've been saying, and manage risk both ways, on the long side and short side, within the range, and again, not playing for sustainable breakouts or breakdowns. Just going more or less playing managing risk within the range.
Yeah, Dana, that's a good point. When there's a choppy market, it makes for good trading to trade the lows, buy the lows and sell the highs. But there has been a trend overall of the general indexes to continue to climb higher. In fact, they quite often pull back to about their 50-day moving average and then get bought right back, head back up again. It doesn't seem like there has been a really sustained correction for some time. So do you think that any of this has to do with some of the momentum traders continuing to also trade that same range where they are almost hungry for the next dip to buy it, and then they sell the next rip and it keeps things in this choppy channel? Do you think that's just the trend that everybody's doing? Because the other side of it that you mentioned, which is interesting, is there's not as much breadth. There's not as many companies participating, and the volumes are lower in the summer. So it seems like everybody's squeezed into the same few dozen stocks, and that's where all the action is, and that's where the ETFs are. Do you think that we'll see this trend break down at one point and see more breadth and see more of a different pattern than what we've seen over, let's say, the last year?
Sure. Well, on the one hand, you make a good point. We're seeing clear uptrends still in the major averages and some of the higher relative strength sectors. So when we're seeing non-confirming breadth, when we're seeing more of a trading range, it doesn't mean that we abandon the long side wholesale. We're going to still concentrate on the on a portion of our portfolio on the long side. We're going to concentrate those on the which we always do, on the high relative strength sectors, which by which I mean, the best performing sectors, those areas of the market that are continuing to perform well and continuing an uptrend. So the large caps, as I mentioned, technology, healthcare, and the like, will continue to buy the dips, as you mentioned, and take some off into take some profits as they hit new highs and get a little bit extended. So yes, on the long side of our book, we continue to buy those areas that are still working. On the flip side, those areas that are lagging, will continue to sell them into resistance or even short them. We are do have some hedges on that we continue to hedge into resistance and then cover those into pullback. So you can play both sides right now in this type of a market. But despite all of, as you alluded to, despite some of the concerns that we have in the broader market, there are still almost always are some areas of the market that are working that you can continue to focus on the long side of your portfolio. On the flip side, with the breadth concerns that we have, those concerns tend to eventually have to be dealt with and reckoned with before a more sustainable upleg is put in place. So we do see the major averages continuing in their uptrend, which means you can continue to focus them on the long side. But with the lack of confirming breadth, with the divergences that we're seeing in the broader market, in the small caps and the mid caps, that tends to suggests that it might not be a sustainable move to new highs, which is one reason we are taking some off the table, even into new highs, once some of these averages are getting extended, because the non-confirming breath signals suggest that, like I said, it's not a sustainable move to new highs. Once we have some sort of a reckoning, some sort of a washout, more of a corrective move that resets at least sentiment, gets more people on the leaning bearish, brings averages back to more of a substantial support area that can provide more of a launch pad, then we will be more aggressive on the long side and expect more of a sustainable move to new highs. So the new highs are great. I would not be very aggressive at this point just because of the lack of breath. So, like I said, on one hand, focus the long side of your book on those areas that are performing well. But don't be surprised if that's not a sustainable move to the upside. And eventually you have some more of a corrective move that puts markets in place for more of a sustainable move to new highs.
So, Dana, big picture, are you saying that these markets are really in need of a larger correction, a bear market almost, that lasts, well, much longer than that March correction does, but rather than the dips constantly being bought, we finally going to see a bear market for U.S. markets?
Well, not in the very immediate term. I'm calling for more of a garden variety pullback, I guess, in the major averages. We did see earlier, I guess, this week or the last or 10 days or so, we're seeing even on the slightest pullback, we're seeing good signs of an increase in fear and a kind of a rush to safety that to me suggests that we wouldn't need that big of a correction to put to reset kind of the investor sentiment to the point where we have enough negativity, enough bearishness that we can, from contrarian standpoint, put in a decent intermediate term low and put in a more of a sustainable up leg in the broader market. However, once we've talked about in the past, some of the background, some of the longer term signals in terms of valuations, in terms of household investment in stocks, which is now hitting all-time records again. So from a long-term standpoint, we're starting to see concerns of type of cyclical concerns, major bear market top or bull market tops and cyclical bear markets that we've seen in the past at major tops. So I don't think we're there yet. I think we get another nice move to new highs, but we should see maybe over the next couple months more of a shallower correction, but one that resets the sentiment picture, sets the breath picture, and allows for at least one more nice push to new highs before some sort of a major top.
Yeah, Dana, you bring up an interesting point there as far as all the new market participants and the participation from particularly retail investors being at highs that it's never been before. There's more people, probably due to the lockdowns for a year and a half, but there's more people investing and opening trading accounts. And there were in 2020 and early 2021, there were still record numbers of new trading accounts being opened at number of brokers. And so most of those people have never been through a big correction. Even if we get a small corrective move that gets, resets the parameters and moves up. We had talked off mic about some of the activity that you're noting that looks like end of cycle activity, just some of the stretched valuations, you know, the volatility indexes are still pretty low. And most of these new traders that piled in the market over the last year or so haven't ever seen a 20, 30, 40% correction that lasted more than a couple of weeks. So what do you think that will look like, or what will you be looking for on some of these end of cycle indicators?
Yeah, that's correct. That's a good point. We're seeing some, you know, signs of, like we saw back in like maybe 2000, the dot-com bubble, the dawn of internet day trading. We saw that kind of a trading orgy, if you will, with new avenues for trading, which basically was just ended up being new avenues for retail investors to lose lots of money. We're seeing that again now with, as you alluded to, the number of new trading accounts that are open now, zero commission trading, which just opens up investors to over trading and losing, opens up more avenues again for ways to lose more money for retail investors. So you're seeing just loads of people rushing and new people, amateurs rushing into the market. And you're seeing one statistic we like to track just because it has a longer term track record. It tracks the household percentage of household assets invested in stocks. And it goes back to the 1940s, tracked by the Fed. And we saw just a major bubble in 2000. We saw it go to the extremes that we've never seen before in the history of the indicator. I didn't think we'd ever see those levels reached again, perhaps in my lifetime. I was wrong. We've just surpassed those 2000 levels. So households are now more invested as a percentage of their assets in stocks than they've ever have been before. So doesn't mean that a top is imminent, but it means there's more risk of losses in the market than there ever has been. And you guys all know that in the end, the retail investor does not win. The way the end of cycle kind of mechanisms work, like you alluded to, is the market always finds ways to suck the most people in and the most dollars in right at the worst time. So what seemed like an extreme in 2000 and seemed like extremes at other major market tops, eventually we find ways to hit new extremes. And I think that's what we're in the process of doing now. I think, like I mentioned before, in the short term, I don't think we're on the verge of a major top here. I think things are still fine in the intermediate term for another up leg to this bull market. But in the background, in the bigger scheme of things, we're seeing a lot of troubling end of cycle stuff that, like you mentioned, that is lining up for a potential major top and potential devastating losses again for retail investors and household investors, like we've seen, you know, in the past 2000 and then 2007 and the housing bubble in 2006. So we're shaping up for that again, unfortunately. And unfortunately, that's one thing that's never going to change markets, because human nature doesn't change. People, since the dawn of time, have put the most money in at the wrong time. And we're seeing that again, and we're going to see that again to another extreme before this is over, I think.
All right. Interesting comments there, Dana. And unfortunately, it is true. Retail, the households are always the last in the market, and they get burned the most on those corrections. Final quick comment. I just want you to touch on that whole inflation trade. It has come back. We saw gold rebounding this week. We also have seen base metals rebounding even earlier. It started a couple weeks ago, I believe. So overall, the inflation trade seems to be back in favor a little bit. Are you riding that wave?
We're trading that range, that wave. I think there's going to be another up leg to it. So we're trading bias to the upside in that inflation trade. Like you mentioned, industrial metals, copper, energy, crude oil, even just the broad commodity indices like the CRB, for example. You got the grains that have all these things, all the whole inflation trade had that big move into the spring or so, early summer. It's just been consolidating since. So I think we're still in the consolidation phase. So right now we're trading it, bought some into the pullback over the last week to 10 days or so, taking some off the table now, as we think we're just still consolidating that that big rally that we had at the beginning of the year. But eventually, I do think there's another up leg to this commodity rally, to that inflation trade, before it runs its course. So yes, we'd be trading it right now, but certainly biased to the long side, because I think there is eventually another up leg to it.
Okay. Dana, thank you, as always, for sharing your insights on these markets. Dana, I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. And you know what? We'll chat again in another couple weeks. And again, you're trading these markets, still riding some of these sectors higher. But some of those longer-term comments about some of the data that you're seeing that relates back to major market tops, put some more ammo in more of the bears camp. But again, maybe not right in the near term. Dana, thanks again for your time. Have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, Corey. Always a pleasure.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of the KE Report. I am replaying a company update from Alloro Resources that we posted on Thursday. I chose to replay this company update because these are some significant drill results. Again, out of Alloro Resources, we received a lot of feedback, positive feedback on the back of this interview. So I did want to highlight it again on this weekend show. But just remember, everybody, we have been featuring a lot of companies with a lot of company updates, because I think in these slow markets, now is the time to reanalyze your portfolio and make sure that the companies you're invested in are doing the right work. And even though the share price might not be moving now, at least the ones doing the right work and having good success should be the shares that bounce back the quickest. I hope you all enjoy this interview. To hear the full Alloro interview, click on that Thursday posting. Hey everyone, welcome in to another daily editorial here on the KE Report. We are getting an update from Alloro Resources, traded on the TSX Venture Exchange under the symbol ELO and on the OTCQX under the symbol ELRRF. Chad and I are chatting with Quentin Henney, the technical advisor over at Alloro Resources, and we are following up on a news release that came out earlier this week, July 28th. It released four more drill hole assay results, the headline number here being 129 grams per ton silver equivalent over 300 meters. And this is the mineralized envelope of the Santa Barbara Breccia pipe, all at this Isca silver tin polymetallic project in Bolivia. Now, Quentin, there are a number of different minerals that came into that silver equivalent calculation. Break down the type of minerals that you saw in the results and the importance, I'm guessing, of each and every one of them.
Okay, that's a really good place to start. Look, these systems in Bolivia are very, very interesting. They're amazing deposits because they host a large number of transitional metals. These are, if you look at the periodic table, basically all those metals kind of in the middle of the periodic table are what we call transition elements. Okay, and these metal-rich porphyries, these metal-rich magmas that came up in Bolivia, tend to generate what we call polymetallic deposits. Okay, these are deposits that have many different metals associated with them. There are many deposits of this type across Bolivia, the southern part of south central Bolivia. This is a prolific belt with many world-class deposits. Potosí is one of the biggest. Well, it is the biggest silver deposit on Earth, but it also has zinc and lead and tin and, you know, a lot of these other metals we have. What do we have? Well, we have silver, we have zinc and lead, we have a bit of tin, and in places we have a lot of tin. Okay, there is a tin porphyry here. We also have copper in places. We have gold in places. We have exotic metals, bismuth, things like indium, cadmium. I could ramble off a few others too. Okay, now one of the challenges we face as a company is presenting this data to investors. People go, oh, wow, that's interesting. There's a lot of metal here. What does it mean? Okay, we break it down and we present it as silver equivalency. Now, we recognize that silver in many places is not necessarily the dominant economic mineral in this. But if you do it in that respect, people tend to rationalize things better. They tend to understand things better. Now, I'm a gold guy, okay? So the numbers that you just rambled off, you know, the 300 meters of 129 gram silver equivalent, if you translate that to gold, I'm talking just raw dollar value, which is what I'm doing here, is about 1.8 gram gold equivalent. Okay, now if this was a gold dominant system and we could report a number like 300 meters of 1.8 gram gold equivalent, I think most people would get that like in a heartbeat. I recognize that there are places in this deposit where one metal might dominate over another. For instance, down in the tin part, there's a lot more value in the tin than there is anything else, including the silver. Other places, we have silver combined with zinc and lead primarily. Okay, so the system is zoned. We've talked about it in a couple of news releases recently. That's why we kind of, you know, it's like having an apple in this drill hole and an orange in this drill hole. We try to present this data in a meaningful way to all investors.
Well, Quentin, I'm glad you clarified that, because there has been a lot of chatter on some of the chat boards about why is it being reported in silver equivalent, and that clears it up. If it was reported in zinc or lead or one of the other minerals, you could still do that, but investors may not be able to interpret it as well as when you put it in silver terms or gold terms. But you brought up the tin there, and there's also been some discussion about what is the importance of the tin in these kind of deposits that we see in Bolivia and these big silver tin systems. So could you also just clarify that again? We've touched on it in the past, but I think it's an important element that you're seeing that tin in there and what that could mean to the economics of a deposit of this size.
Certainly. Look, the porphyries, the magmas that are kind of solidified down in the ground, kind of a little bit below these deposits, are often tin rich, all right? And in this case, our tin porphyry is a bit further south from where these drill holes that were announced in this release are located. Okay, so the tin porphyry is more down towards the central part of this target area that we're drilling. Now, the tin at Iskia, in some of the tin intercepts or the drill holes that we've drilled down into that regime, the tin is running 0.4, 0.5%. You can look back at our previous news release. This is a few weeks ago. And you'll see some very high-grade tins. Now, that's astonishing, guys. 0.4% tin, for example, is about twice the grade of most tin porphyries in Bolivia. So to me, that says this is a very strong system. It's demonstrating it can make high-grade tin. Tin is now around $37,000 a metric ton. If people don't understand tin, the meaning of that, that's almost, not quite, but almost four times the price of copper. Okay, think about that for a minute. 0.4% tin, holy cow, that's like saying 1.6% copper almost, you know, or something of that ilk. Like, again, we're trying to help people rationalize this by making comparison to what this means in context of other types of intercepts they might be more familiar with.
So, Quentin, it does sound like people are still wondering about the economics of a project like this because of all the different minerals. And I understand what you're saying. There's many of these do carry some very nice values. But when it comes to mining these deposits, is there complexities around it? What can you tell us about maybe other deposits that are very similar to this that are being mined and how you can mine a deposit like this?
Yes, there's actually a number of deposits of this type being mined in Bolivia. And, you know, I'll pick Minera San Cristobal as an example. Minera San Cristobal is a ways west of Iskia. I think it's about 100 kilometers due west, or more or less. I might be off by a bit. But it is mining primarily zinc-lead mineralization with silver. Okay, the grade of silver, I believe, is hovering around 20 gram per ton silver. And the combined zinc and lead maybe constitute about 1.6% okay, what is Minera San Cristobal do? What does it deliver? Well, look, it is a remarkable deposit. It's been mined for about 11 or 12, maybe 13 years now, continuously, and it has been one of the best economic returns for Sumitomo Corporation. It is a wonderful deposit. Okay, the zinc and the lead basically pay, and this is at 1.6%, guys. The zinc and the lead pay for the cost of mining and processing. Okay, guess what? That means the silver is for free. Now, there was a time where they were producing around, I think, 20 or 25 million ounces of silver per annum. I think it's now on the order of 10 to 15 million ounces per annum. But you quickly do some math in your head. You go, oh, let's see, silver's $25, or maybe it's a little more today. And they're producing, call it 12 million ounces of silver. And, you know, that lead zinc is going to pay for the costs. That means their silver is basically their free cash flow. That's a way to think of it. Okay, 12 million ounces of silver at $25 an ounce. Yeah, that's about 300 million U.S. Okay, that's amazing. These types of deposits absolutely kill a pig when it comes to economics. Pan American's operating there. There's other deposits that are currently being developed. There's other styles, like the Andean guys, for example, are mining the oxide material, you know, where this is basically the near surface oxide material, but they're also dealing with this polymetallic stuff. Again, they're making great money. These are great deposits. They make a lot of money.
Well, Quentin, there's no doubt that there's a lot of metal at this deposit and over wide intercepts, and there's a lot of continuity. So some of the other questions have been like, hey, there's no doubt this is looking like a good deposit. It's still early days and there's still a lot of exploration to go, but some of the chatter has also been, are there any deleterious elements in there that would be smelter penalties, and what kind of concentrates would you have to produce from this many different types of metals? Do you have any handle on that yet, or is it still too early to be looking at that? I know you would need to do some MET testing and everything, but what will the company do as you move down the pike on the MET testing and determine what kind of concentrates you'd produce?
Certainly. Look, what we have in hand right now is the multi-element data from analyses of our drill core. We can see a wide spectrum of elements. I think there's on the order of 50 elements that are reported in that data. It includes a lot of the deleterious elements. Okay, so things like arsenic and, you know, some people say, well, cadmium is deleterious. Well, it is, but if it's in high enough concentration, the smelters will make a concerted effort to collect that, metal. In other words, it can go from being a penalty metal to actually payable metal, at least at the smelter. So that's up for debate. But arsenic is actually reasonably low. It's in the, you know, few hundred ppm. That's pretty consistent with most base metal deposits of any type that I've seen. So no, I don't see high deleterious elements. I don't see there's certainly no significant mercury. Antimony is fairly low. You know, these are the ones you worry about most. I don't see them here. We're doing MET work, so the company will have more detailed data in the next few months. But I look around at analogs, okay, and I look around at all the deposits in this region, and all of them generate really high-grade, high-quality concentrates. In this case, in theory at least, without having all the MET data back yet, what I would likely conclude at this point is this will make a great tin concentrate through gravity. It will make a wonderful zinc concentrate of sphalerite through flotation. The lead will also be targeted, and you'll probably also scavenge copper too. Okay, so you'll have multiple concentrates. Things like silver will likely report with lead. That is typically the case. Maybe some of it goes to the zinc, don't know. Things like gold will often also report with the lead. We do have a bit of gold here in there. So yes, like all of these metals will basically go down their respective, you know, pigeonhole, like in terms of processing. They'll each come out in a flow sheet, a technique that's well defined and is used elsewhere across a number of these deposits in Bolivia.
All right, Quentin, let's focus a bit on the drilling that is still ongoing here. So the news release says the company has already completed 46 diamond drill holes for a total of a little over 22,000 meters. There are still three rigs on site. Give us a little insights into where the news will be coming from, where these drills are drilling, and what you hope to prove with the continued drilling.
Okay, we got three rigs turning at site, just like you said. Two of them are surface rigs. They're drilling from drill pads on surface. One of them is an underground rig. And what we're trying to do is do enough drilling. Bill Pearson, who's overseeing the project along with Osvaldo Arte, do intend to drill enough to put together a resource at some point. It's going to largely focus on the northern area where we've got most of our drill results, like these here, back right now. So the underground rig is actually drilling from some small artisanal adits up in that area. There is, you know, historic production or historic exploration through adits, and they're big enough to get a drill rig in. So like this DHK-18, which was announced today, is actually drilled from underground. All right, so that rig's going to continue drilling. By the way, it saves a lot of meters when you drill from underground. Anyway, it's going to continue drilling that general area to infill and help develop that resource. Now, the two surface rigs, one of them's down around the central breccia. It's drilling from surface and testing, testing outwards, looking for the limits of the system. And, you know, it's remarkable, but we have yet to find the limits of the darn thing. Every hole that we drill, you know, we continue to see mineralization. So that surface rig at central, we'll keep drilling a series of radial holes there. And then the other rig, the third rig, which is also a surface rig, is finishing up a series of drill holes down at Porco. Porco is another breccia pipe down at the southern end, the south margin of the caldera. And it has drilled a series of holes. We've talked about those. A lot of sulfide mineralization in all of those holes. Again, we have yet to find the limits of the system. That rig, once it's done drilling the hole that it's on right now, I believe it's going to move to the area kind of between Porco and Central. The reason is we believe there is a very well-defined target in this, what we call gap zone, between Central Breccia and Porco. So it's going to start testing there. So basically right now what we're trying to do is really infill the immediate target for resource, but also gradually step out from these with these surface rigs, trying to feel our way out and around this system. Ultimately we will define the limits of it. I don't know when, but it's growing and growing every time we drill a hole right now.
Well, Quentin, there's absolutely a lot of work going on by the company and a lot of interesting drilling to come. Over the next, let's say, few months, what are the main things investors should keep their eye on, or what's the main takeaway you want investors to get about the work that Elora is doing on exploration right now?
This system is best thought of as a completely preserved podocete-type system. We've demonstrated that now. We've hit tin porphyry, okay? There's been several news releases in which holes show clearly we have a high-grade tin system in places here. We have other areas where we're seeing the zinc-lead-silver mineralization and, bits of gold and copper and so forth. What people have to understand is that we have the entire system preserved here. There is no erosion of significance that's taken it down and taken off a lot of the cream part of the system. It's still sitting there in the subsurface. It's a pristine podocete type system. Remarkable deposit. It's going to take a while to drill out. It's a huge system, but it is an amazing discovery. I think it'll be one of the biggest discoveries of this type in a generation.
Okay, that wraps up this weekend show. Again, I hope you all enjoyed the weekend show. I hope everybody in Canada has a great long weekend. Please keep all the emails coming, fleck@kereport.com or shad@kereport.com. Let us know what companies you're interested in, who you want to see on the show, and what topics you want to hear more about. Everyone, thanks for tuning in this weekend. I look forward to getting back at it next week and keeping you all up to date.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.